I'm Mark Steiner, and we're about to begin one of our Urbanite special interviews are Q&As for the Urbanite magazine. We're about to talk to Joseph Jones. Joe Jones is the founder and president of the Center for Urban Families and is vice chair of the OSI Institute here in Baltimore, OSI Baltimore, I should say. And Joe, it's good to see you again, man. Welcome.
Good to see you as always. Don't forget the tagline
of our
organization.
Oh, helping fathers and families work.
And most important.
That's it. Sorry. Got to have the tagline.
That's right.
I'm curious, a couple of number of levels, some things you've been thinking about maybe, about the importance of families in the lives of children. Some people look at, let's say, in the inner city at the moment, mm-hmm. of kids, the perception of children kind of running amok without supervision, without any kind of parental guidance at all. Talk to me about what you think the situation is and how real that is and what it means.
Well, I think to some degree it's very real in terms of families that are really challenged, in terms of being able to provide the longitudinal, consistent, intimate relationship with the children that adults bring into the world. Right. And when we think about it in the context of family, really, when we think about the way in which we have designed interventions for families in our country, it really is code for women and children. Right. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because women and children need to be supported. But when you think about the way in which children come into this world, being born to two parents, and, generally speaking, we're talking about a mom and a dad. One of the biggest challenges I think we face as a community, as a nation, is the number of children who grow up in families where the fathers are not present. I think that is at the crux of all of the challenges we have with children not having the level of support consistently going from the home, going out into the community, and going into our schools.
Now, take a step backwards for a moment. Your own childhood. Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in a two-parent family?
It depends.
What do you mean?
When I was born to two parents who were married, who were both aspiring professionals. My mom went on to become a nurse. My father went on to become an educator. But they separated and divorced when I was nine. And I can tell you from personal experience that that was probably the most devastating period that I can think of going back as far as I can remember. And I say that because I was the only child. We lived in the projects in East Baltimore and what used to be called Lafayette Court Public Housing Projects. It was a 11-story high-rise complex on the east side. And I didn't even realize that we were kind of poor. You know what I mean? I had a mom and dad who tag-team raising me, and I was in this cocoon, you know, being protected and raised and nurtured by them. When they divorced, my mom and I moved from East Baltimore, where I knew everybody, my friends, family, to some degree, were all there. That's where I went to school. We moved to the 1000 block of Emerson Avenue.
West Baltimore,
right near Emerson and Arlington, where I absolutely knew no one. So I'm a young African-American male. I'm living with a mom who is working and going to school. And I began to have time and get exposed to things I never was exposed to. Although we lived in the projects and there were some things going on around me, I was kind of cocooned or protected, you know, from those things. But when we got to West Baltimore, all hell broke loose in terms of the people I began to associate with, the things I saw that I only kind of tangentially heard about when I was in the projects with both parents. And I began to associate with guys who were doing things and who were a few years older than I was. You know, now I'm at the period where I'm 11, 12, 13 years old. And the guys I was beginning to hang with were like 16 years old, you know. And when you're 13, a 16-year-old is almost like God. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever they say, whatever they experience is almost like that's got to be real. And not having my father in the household anymore and only having limited contact with him, it kind of my image of what life was transitioned from that cocoon environment with both of my parents to this sort of like street culture environment, and it influenced me to a great degree. Some people would say, well, Joe, that's a crutch. And, you know, that's arguable that, it, you know, that I may see that as a crutch, but it was my experience. And at 13, I went from, you know, a person who was in school on a regular basis, living in a household with two people, to injecting heroin. You know,
I that did, young,
that young, you know, and I began to get exposed to the drug trade in terms of drug dealing, which was really a relatively hard phenomenon for a young person to do, because the drug trade during that time was controlled by older adult males. Right. And they, and as best they could, they really tried to protect young males from getting into the game, so to speak. You know, but there was a group of us who penetrated that, you know, that the shield, if you will, and we got into that game.
Your mother didn't know. What was your mother's response to this? Did she know that you were doing drugs that young?
No.
How did you hide that from her?
No, because, you know, when you start off, at least in my experience, when, you know, I started off doing drugs, it was not, and I was only doing heroin at the time. It
wasn't only doing, you know,
only doing heroin.
Only heroin.
You know, it wasn't debilitating. You know what I mean? It wasn't to the extent where my behavior changed dramatically. And, you know, she was working. She was going to school. She was doing the best she could to raise her boy. And I was doing a real good job of hiding what I was doing. You know, I was in school. I wouldn't say I was of school, but I was still in school.
Were you failing?
No, I wasn't failing. I was actually, I was passing along. It's ironic. I ended up acquiring a GED. When I was in the 12th grade, but all up into the 12th grade, I was in school, you know, and I was passing year after year.
And getting now, high.
Getting high. Now, I did get, the first time I was arrested, I was 14. And ironically, because my mother, she attempted to teach me a lesson. So when I got arrested, this is when they used to take you to the precinct station, you know, and they had the cell store in the precinct station as opposed to central booking. And she said, I'm going to leave you there and I'll come get you, because it was over the weekend. It was the Easter weekend. Came back from the Easter weekend and I had to go to juvenile court. Because she left me there, right? So she's at court. I show up at court. And the juvenile master, he says, well, you know, no, I'm not going to release him. I'm going to send him away for 30 days. Man, you know, she was shocked. I was shocked. Now, I wasn't a bad person. I had never really been in trouble. You know what I mean? And so I was sent away for 30 days. And as a result, I missed a portion of time that put me out of school. So when I came back, out of that 30-day institution.
Where they send you?
Children's Center, right? Juvenile facility. I don't even know if it still exists, to tell you the truth. Probably not. But, you know, this is still when we had the junior high school system.
Right.
And then Mayor Schaefer initiated this new program that was a GED-like program that you could take a test and go from junior high to high school, and I was in the first cohort that passed that test to go from junior high to high school. So that's how I got to high school, and then I matriculated, and actually matriculated is probably not the appropriate phrase, because I went to several different high schools, got expelled from all of the high schools that I attended, with the exception of Northwestern High School, where it was the last high school I attended. But I was in the 12th grade, and I had an opportunity to work for the federal government. And but you had to have a high school diploma. And I decided to take the GED examination because I wanted this federal job. And ironically, when I went to apply to take the GED exam, they said I couldn't because I needed to be off the school rolls for X period of time, and I wasn't. I was still going to Northwestern. And somehow they sent me test dates in the mail, and I got the test dates. I went and took the GED examination in April of the year that I would have graduated from high school. In June, I received my diploma in the mail, and I took it to the federal government as an addict, you know, a young addict, still not really, you know, in a debilitated state at that point. I got a job at the federal government in 1975, and I worked there until I got caught in a DEA drug sting. I was selling drugs on federal property, got caught up in a drug sting, and ironically didn't lose the job, but I pled guilty to a federal drug distribution charge, and was fortunate enough to get probation, and was able to maintain my job. However, I was in a management training trajectory mm-hmm. at the federal government, which they put me out of. So I would, in my view, I was going to stay stuck in the bowels of the federal government, and did not want to do that. So I left to go work for the B&O Railroad, and did that for 5 years. But that's when I had my first child out of wedlock, wasn't responsible for him, wasn't performing on the job, and really began to, that's when the debilitation really began to, when I look back, I can see that is where the level of my addiction got to the point where it became unmanageable, in part because it was at the point where I had been doing heroin for such a long time, and now I was doing heroin and cocaine. And the two as a combination, man, I think at the height of my addiction, I spent on a daily basis somewhere between $600 and $650 daily, Just imagine what it takes.
To hustle that kind of money.
For one person to hustle. And I wasn't unique. You know what I mean? So you multiply that by X number of people with that level of addiction in any urban community, and you can, you can extrapolate from that some of the debilitating stuff that we see in our communities.
So tell me about what's going on with the role of families in all this. I mean, that we have families either that are working too hard to take care of their children, or mothers mm-hmm. working to take care of their children. You have kids growing up who never really had any parental training. In other words, there are young kids who are becoming parents.
Too soon.
Too soon. Mm-hmm. But they had no role models in terms of how to become a parent. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't kind of go to class to become a parent. You mm-hmm. learn your parenting from your parents.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So here you have a situation in a community where people unemployment is high. You have kids having kids, and parents not around. So, talk about what you consider to be the familial scene in the inner city at the moment.
Well, I think one of the huge challenges we have, the number of out of wedlock birth rate of births among particularly minorities. Is extremely high in the African-American community. I kind of look at it, in practical terms. If you've got a city block and there are 20 houses, 10 on each side, and you've got a two-parent family in each one of those houses, right? When one or two families have challenges and the situation in that family disintegrates and you end up having single-parent households and two of those 20 houses, the ability for that neighborhood, that block, to absorb that is relatively high because the percentage of single parent households is still 2 out of 20, right? But when you start multiplying that and you end up now having neighborhoods where if you look at that same, scenario of 20 houses and the overwhelming majority of them single-parent households, the likelihood that a community can absorb that and it won't negatively impact children's outcome and the ability of the community to function, and it doesn't impact, a single parent, whether it's a mom or dad, and more likely than not, it's a mom, and it impacts her ability to realize her own goals. She has to struggle, as a single parent, trying to be mom and dad, and then you have children who are coming out of households where men aren't present. So their values, their behavior, the way in which they interact with other people begins to be challenged. And then they go into school systems where we have, far and few men who are in there as educators, so you really don't have any way for their behavior in the school system to be tempered by a male presence, right? And then you multiply that 10 times over in communities and neighborhoods across the city, then all of a sudden what you have is this population of young boys and young girls who are not necessarily bad people, But what they are being exposed to, the things that they're doing, they're looking for love, sort of like in, you know, in all the wrong places. And now with the proliferation of gangs, we have young people who, as opposed to matriculating from high school to college, are dropping out of high school, matriculating into gangs. You know, and even young people who are in school are being impacted by the proliferation of gangs. And so when you think about, at least the way in which I think about it, the fact that we as a society have not addressed the needs of fathers is one of the issues that still is an untapped resource in terms of helping families to become stable. You know, I think we've tried to incarcerate our way out of this. You know, we build more prisons. You know, we put more laws on the books. You know, we've got the you know, with the gun trade being so robust and access to guns and drugs, we've tried everything to deal with these issues. The one thing that I have not seen us do in terms of a public policy related to families is to figure out how do we help a mom and a dad that has a child to stabilize their relationship, understand how to nurture it, right? And ideally, the two of them will be together for the rest of their child's life. But even if the relationship doesn't work, you know, how do we help them to understand that they have a joint responsibility to co-parent their child?
So if you're saying that in some ways that we're just looking at the inner city African-American world, mm-hmm. for a moment, I mean, because we can talk, I think families in larger contexts have many issues going on in society.
Correct.
But that in that context, you have, If the disintegration of the black family, some mm-hmm. people see in the inner city, has this root in the destruction of our industrial base and jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's one of the things that mm-hmm. has caused the breakup of the family.
Yeah, and we need to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. And you are seeing the situation going on now where families don't exist, and you have to have parenting classes to teach people how to be parents.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty scary situation. That's what we're doing. How do families become stabilized without a job base? I mean, you can train people to be parents all day long, but if there's not a way to keep families, people stable in a relationship, I mean, you know, it's I've always said to some people that I'd like to see the day when inner city families could have a good divorce. You know, except mm-hmm. with a father around. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you create that situation where there's some stability in this?
Well, I think it's important to understand that for people to understand that it used to be a period in our history when a person of limited education, right, or hearts or skills, could acquire a job that paid family sustaining wages, right? Particularly during the manufacturing era, right? That no longer exists in any significant way. So now when we have the number of children born out of wedlock, right, the number of people who want to work, right, who don't have technical skills, not able to get the kind of jobs that used to pay a family sustaining wage without the, you know, advanced education that, you know, is required of many of the technical jobs and service industry jobs today, then any species has got to do something in a capitalistic society to earn resources, right? Sometimes you do things that are entrepreneurial and legal and honest, right? But they don't necessarily, at a large scale, produce the kind of income, you know, that will pay family sustaining wages, right? But what we've kind of flipped around to is sort of like a short kind of sighted way of particularly young minority males taking a different pathway to an economy, usually an underground illegal economy, right? It pays more in some cases than family sustaining wages. However, the destruction of community associated with that lifestyle is such that it's almost impossible for communities to recover without intentional activities to address the needs of the males in their community, increasingly women in the community as well.
So where do you take it? What happens to the children?
Well, I think that, you know, what we found is that children's outcomes in our country in terms of child well-being are as much effort as we put into improving child outcomes, it's limited by our ability to engage the men to help them bring them into the world. And I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a study called the Fragile Families Child Well-Being Study. This is a study that's a longitudinal study being conducted by Princeton and Columbia Universities, right? The study is in 20-something cities, including Baltimore, where they survey women who are low-income women who are giving birth in the hospitals, right? And they try to ascertain the status of the relationship between the pregnant mom and the mom's partner, mm-hmm. right? Around the time of the birth of the child, the women indicate they're in a romantic relationship, right, with the expectant father. They have aspirations to marry, right? They have aspirations to be good caregivers to their children, right? But a year, 2 years down the road, those expectations and aspirations aren't realized, and those relationships begin to disintegrate, right? And this is from the Fragile Families Child Well-Being Study, right? Then if those relationships begin to disintegrate, right, there should be some intervention at that point, right? And I want to pause here, and I want to talk about what happens and give a real concrete kind of example of looking at our welfare offices or the TANF system. So you got a fictitious couple, Keisha and Raheem, right? Mm-hmm. Keisha's pregnant and she's poor. Raheem is poor, but they meet one another and they enter into a relationship and Keisha gets pregnant, right? From a public policy standpoint, we want to make sure she's seen prenatally and we want to make sure that she eats healthy so that the fetus develops and is born healthy, right? Because the issues associated with poor birth outcomes from a cost standpoint is even more hellacious, right? So where are Keisha and Raheem likely to go for resources, right? Well, if they're poor and their families of origin are poor, they're going to go to the welfare office, generally speaking, right? So Keisha goes to the welfare office. She says, I'm pregnant and I need some support to make it through. The welfare office says, Keisha, given your situation, you meet the eligibility requirements. However, we need to know about Raheem, right? And the welfare office only needs to know about Raheem because in order for Keisha to be eligible for the benefits, Raheem has to be held accountable for paying back the system through the child support mechanism for the benefits that Keisha and the fetus and ultimately the child will receive, right? So Keisha gets these benefits, and the benefits that she receives is basically a loan to Raheem dollar for dollar. That's how child support, you know, begins to accrue. Now, the system, the welfare system right now, right, is not set up so that when Keisha comes in, the caseworker says, okay, we need to know about Raheem for this child support stuff, right? Because he does have a moral and financial obligation to assist financially, right? However, let's think about this. We know that around the birth of the child, this relationship is still likely to be romantic. Wouldn't it make more sense that the caseworker be trained so that when Keisha comes in, the caseworker says, I want you to think about bringing Raheem in because we also want to think about a set of services that are for the two of you, not just you, Keisha, but for you and Raheem. Let's think about if he's got to be financially held accountable for child support, what do we now need to do to think about getting him into the labor market, right, so he has the ability to pay? It makes no sense really to hit him over the head and hammer him for child support, but don't understand that he may have multiple barriers to labor force attachment, right? And so we're going to hold him accountable and create this debt, but we aren't also going to simultaneously help him get into the labor
market. So let's talk about what you think is a strategy then for mm-hmm. rebuilding families in the inner city mm-hmm. on this model, mm-hmm. the Raheem Keisha model.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that destroyed the family in the beginning in the early 60s, late 50s, were the welfare rules that said you're not going to get you can't have these welfare payments if the father's in that if there's a man in the house.
Correct.
So that destroyed
the old man in the house rule.
Right. Mm-hmm. And people vilified Daniel Moynihan in the early 60s for writing a mm-hmm. book about saying the state of the black family. They thought it was a racist book, but in fact, I think it was, even though we might have called him a racist back then, he wasn't. He was telling the truth about what was going to happen mm-hmm. to the black family. Mm-hmm. and it came home to roost. So what do you do, taking this Raheem Keisha model, and you redesign a system that builds families in the inner city? How does that happen?
I think you do a couple of things. One, I think if you look at the social welfare system that we just talked about in terms of our departments of social services, we need to retrain and reorient those systems so that when a pregnant mom comes in, right, and we've got data through the Fragile Families Child Wellbeing Studies that suggest they are still romantically linked at that time, we need to reorient that system so they engage both parents, right, not just engage Keisha for the benefits and Raheem for the obligation to pay child support. And we think about creating a service plan that's for them as a family unit, right? And then we think about the economic supports that the two of them need, the economic, the education support, the child care supports that they need, so that the child has the likelihood of having a relationship, both of those parents, consistently over the course of their child's development, right? Secondly, we need to kind of think about what our public policies are. And right now we have, for example, a set of federal demonstration grants that provide resources, $50 million a year over a five-year period. We're approaching the end of the fourth year of these federal grants. These are federal fatherhood grants. These are grants to communities, including the state of Maryland, right, to help think through how to engage these low-income men in communities and encouraging them to come above ground and be involved in the life of their children, right? Now, the problem is, for many of the low-income men that we're talking about, they distrust systems, right? They've been engaged in the criminal justice system, right? They have been ineffectively engaged by the education system. So even when you reach out to them, there's this trust factor, right? We got to create more opportunities where these young men can come above ground, play the mainstream game, and public policy doesn't cut off their necks, right? So we got to think about policy reform, particularly around child support. Child support is one of the most...
How would you change that?
Well, the state of Maryland actually has an initiative called the Child Support Incentive Payment Program, right? And how does this work, and why do we even have it, right? So let's look at Raheem again, since we've been playing around with Raheem, right? Raheem has he's helped bring a child into the world, and now his child support has accrued to the point he hasn't been able to pay it,
right,
because he hasn't had a job, right? But child support is consistently trying to find him, you know, maybe even incarcerating him for past debt, right? Well, this child support incentive program that's on the books here in the state of Maryland, as long as Raheem gets a job, a legal job with a pay stub, right, and he's paying consistently over a 12-month period on his original child support order. I'm not talking about the debt that has accrued, but I'm talking about the monthly payment, right? So he pays that consistently over a 12-month period of time, and this is state debt. So this is money that's owed to the state, not owed directly to the custodial parent, right? If he does that consistently for a 12-month period, then the amount of debt that he has accrued can be wiped off the books.
So you pay child support, mm-hmm, you take care of your child for X amount of dollars,
mm-hmm,
for a year,
mm-hmm,
but you have X plus Y amount of dollars that they say you owe because you've not paid child support all these years,
mm-hmm,
and the system's been paying this woman who's paying Keisha because she had the baby, then that X plus Y debt is wiped out.
Correct. Right? And so what the state is able to do is to collect money from a population that has not been paying. Right. But it's a balance between giving people an opportunity. Right. But also having them pay for an order that's already on the books. But and so some people question, well, why would we as taxpayers want to do that? Well, one, I want Raheem to have a relationship with that child. I want Raheem to be a caregiver who's in a position to help shape the values and the beliefs of that child. I want to be working with Raheem to help him understand how to manage his own behavior so he doesn't end up producing other children that he's not in a position to take care of. You know, so this multiplier effect is what is killing us, right? We've got to begin to figure out how to work with parents early enough to give them the kind of support that will allow them to make the decisions relative to their parental responsibilities.
So how do you create parenthood in all of this? In other words, It's one thing to give child support. It's one thing to say, okay, the father's in the kid's life. The mother's getting the correct health the program to make sure the child is healthy when it's born. And getting its shots and all the rest. All that's important. But Keyshawn and Raheem have both grown up in homes maybe that were not real families, where the mother was alone and didn't know how to be a parent, and her mother didn't know how to be a parent for her.
And Raheem hasn't had a father. He doesn't know where the father is.
And what a father's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and you have this philosophy sometimes among some, put it on the table, in some inner city families where it's you've got to be tough on your children because the streets are tough and they got to be ready for them. So, you know, corporal punishment is a huge part of it. But the balance of the other things are not there. So how do you you have to literally begin to teach parenting.
Well, if you just think about this, let's take what you just said and unpack that a little bit. Let's think about where this kind of plays itself out in terms of the helping professions, right? And let's just take social work as an example, right? Social workers are trained to be helping professionals, right? So, and there are people who focus their discipline on family dynamics, right, within the helping professional within social work, right? Academically, our universities and colleges, our schools of social work, don't do a very good job of training young aspiring professionals to understand what it means to be a helping professional who works with families, right, that includes fathers, right? So that means that, for example, I went to a school of social work, right? I was one of a couple of males in the class, right? Most of my academic training had nothing to do with understanding the needs of fathers as it relates to them needing support and services when there's some issue that comes up, right? Matter of fact, if you think about the way in which we dispense dedicated public funding that would have anything to do with men in our country, there are really only two dedicated public funding streams to have anything to do with men in our country. And I'll point them out to you. And matter of fact, I'll ask you, can you tell me the two dedicated public funding streams to have anything to do with men across ethnic or economic strata?
Prisons and the military?
Well, let's take the military out, because arguably the military is one.
Right.
Prison is one, the criminal justice
right.
system.
Right.
And the second is the child support system.
Okay.
Right? So let's think about this. And you got a young family in Baltimore that's, you know, doesn't have the economic means to take care of itself, and they need some help as a family. So they go to, let's just use Johns Hopkins as an example.
Mm-hmm.
The young lady shows up at the some office that deals with maternal and child health, right? So she looks at the directory, and there is a table of contents and a plethora of resources around maternal and child health, right? Well, let's look at dad in terms of paternal health. There is no paternal health directory, right? There is no paternal health infrastructure in terms of social welfare services or policy. So in the context of a family, we're really talking about supporting women and children, again, rightfully so, but it's structurally flawed because a family includes the man who helps to bring these children into the world. And we've got to figure out, right? We've got to do something that has not been done in any significant way, and that is invest in families that include fathers. Now, we've done that through private philanthropy to a great degree. We've had many national foundations. Baltimore's really blessed because the Annie E. Casey Foundation has had a longstanding investment in what's called responsible fatherhood. They actually have a portfolio. They've worked on it from a policy, a research, and a practice standpoint, right? What we haven't had is the public resources, right, that support the kind of work that Casey has invested in, right? And we've gotten legislation on the books, for example, during 2006 and 2007, then Senator Barack Obama and Senator Evan Bayh from Indiana, they introduced some legislation called the Responsible Fatherhood and Healthy Families Act of 2006, 2007. It wasn't reintroduced in 2008. Barack Obama decided to run for president. He has talked ad nauseum in his speeches, in his writings, and now as president about the responsibility of men taking their rightful role in the family and helping to raise children, right? This year, Senator Evan Bayh in the Senate and Representative Danny Davis from Chicago in the House introduced what's called the Responsible Fatherhood and Healthy Families Act of 2009, right? Mm-hmm. This public legislation will, if passed, will provide an additional public resource that communities, state governments, nonprofit organizations, criminal justice institutions can apply for, right, to begin to address the needs of low-income men who happen to be fathers. About 65% to 70% of men who are incarcerated are fathers. Right. So think about the impact of communities where we've taken the men from the community, we've incarcerated them, but their children remain in the communities. Right. And what does that do for a child who's growing up without their father around? Their father, most of the people who are going to be incarcerated in our country are going to be released. Right. And our public policy up until recently was to simply dump people back into the community and say, hey, you know, go get a job, you know, go see your parole or probation officer and do the best you can on your own. That is unrealistic in terms of the devastation and kind of where we have left, you know, the men who are responsible, who should be responsible for their children. We've got to have intentional public policy. We've got to have intentional intervention that focuses on the family as a whole, not just women and children.
So in order to bring familial structure back to an inner city world, a world of poverty, you're saying you have to change the entire way we address our social service system.
We've got to do it, and it has to include jobs. It absolutely has to, and not just jobs, right? We are as an organization, we're looking at this concept that we call family stability and economic success, right? Because we, you know, I've run a jobs program that includes fathers for a number of years, and I've had women come to me and say, I'm so glad you helped my partner to get a job. But when he gets paid, you know, he doesn't, like, buy Pampers, right? So the employer tells us, man, he's a great employer. But the mom is saying he's not managing his resources well, right? So we're talking now about not just getting into the labor market and earning income, but we're talking about understanding the principles and concepts of financial literacy, you know? And then, you know, you take that a step further, okay? So you say, well, what does that mean? Okay, let's make it real practical. Let's take Raheem again. Let's go back to Raheem. So Raheem has this, you know, this debt, right? And we're working with Raheem. We got him into a program. Raheem says, man, you know what? I don't want to live like I've been living, man. I care about my children. I care a bit about my baby's mother. You know, I want a job. I want to work, man. You know, I've done some things I'm not really proud of, you know, but I'm trying to change my life around. So we say, okay, Raheem, I'm taking you at your word. Right now, you don't have much more than your word, but I'm going to take you at that. So Raheem, we get him a job, right? So we say, Raheem, when you get paid, man, we need to have you think about, you know, not keeping your money in your pocket, but, you know, connecting with a financial institution, right? So Raheem trusts us, right? So Raheem said, well, you know, I really never had a bank account, right? But he trusts us. So we helped Raheem get a bank account. But if we don't deal with this outstanding child support issue, right? And keep in mind, the child support enforcement system has almost as many enforcement tools as the IRS. Right. So we're going to tell Raheem he should put his paycheck in a bank that can be levied.
Right.
By the child support system. So that's not practical. Right. For Raheem. Right. And it challenges our credibility in the community. So we also have to work with legislators and policymakers to get them to understand how do we begin to design public policy that is a little bit more reflective of the reality of lives of low income men, particularly in an environment where we have a down economy, right? That's in general, we need to do that. But when it's a down economy, it's even more pronounced.
I never thought about that what you just said. I mean, that connection, that you know, we have a system in the state where family where we promote the lottery. Just waste all your money in the inner city and buy yourself $10, $20 worth of tickets at a time every day.
Yeah.
to win this magic number, you're never going to win.
That's right.
Most likely.
Yeah, that's right. And if you win, you scratch off and you win $5, right?
You buy five more tickets.
Or you pay $10 to win $5. You're in the hole for five.
You're in the hole. But young men can't be shown how to save money in a bank. America needs to be known how to save money in a bank.
Right, correct.
Begin to live frugally and kind of how you build up a stash of money, because that money in the bank can be tapped by the government to pay back what they spent on Keisha. So Raheem can't put his money in the bank because it'll be taken by the
government.
It'll
be garnished. That's right. And here's the other thing. Here's the other nuance, particularly within workforce development, right? So just Raheem and Keisha. So let's say we want the welfare department, when Keisha goes in for benefits, to engage both of them, right? And that means we want both of them to get into the labor market after Keisha has the baby and she's in the position to be able to do so, right? However, right, in terms of workforce development, there is no literature on how to serve couples in workforce development. We can serve individuals, male or female, but we don't have literature about serving couples like a Raheem and a Keisha. So one of the things that we are exploring, right, with resources that we receive from the federal government, is how to design workforce development initiatives for couples. How do we get them to think about mapping out their job and career aspirations? How to get them to think about, thinking about, if Keisha wants to do job training X and Raheem wants to do, construction, and, what is that schedule like? How do they coordinate that so that they don't go off kind of half-cocked and do it uncoordinated?
So knowing all this stuff and with your ideas about how you could change the system and work, and knowing that young people need supervision and need kind of parental guidance to survive and grow into adulthood, and there's all this sense of that the inner city streets are out of control that way. There are young people in the streets with no real adult supervision of any kind. And you talk about this model that might make it work. So why are you not completely depressed that it's not happening? Why are you not, how can you be so ebullient about where this thing may be going?
Man, Mark.
Given what we're facing.
I spent 17 years as a heroin and cocaine addict. A good percentage of that time I spent in and out of incarceration, right? When I look at where I came from, right, in some instances, I almost think I unintentionally tried to kill myself. If you think about the amount of chemicals I injected into my body, right, and God said, boy, you trying to take yourself out of here, and I'm trying to keep you here. I got a different plan for you, right? And so now that he's given me an opportunity to come out of that abyss, so the last time I injected heroin or cocaine or any other substance was October the 4th, 1986. Right. So now I have 20 plus years behind me. God gave me an opportunity to do things and live life in a different way. I have a mandate to be able to, look at addressing these issues. Right. Not being pessimistic about them, being real about them, and then saying to policymakers, right, we want you to consistently look at what is happening in the lives of people and the potential, and to design public policy that is intended to try to address these issues in ways in which you've never thought about, and have a conversation just like we had that conversation about child support and, getting connected to a financial institution, right? Many policymakers don't even think of it in concrete terms.
Well,
like
a lot of policymakers might also say, though, conservative policymakers might say, he owes the money. He didn't live up to his responsibilities. So it's our duty to get that money from him.
Yeah, and I think Raheem has an obligation to pay. I'm not saying he doesn't have an obligation to pay, but I'm saying if somebody has debt that unrealistically he is never, ever going to be able to pay. Most financial institutions, Mark, if you show up with debt on your credit card, right, that you're not going to pay, credit card companies write that debt off, right? In terms of a public policy dealing with child support, we got to figure out how do we hold him accountable but be flexible enough in our policies so that he can come above ground. We get him into the labor market and put him in a position where he can pay. But there's no sense in trying to hold him accountable for debt that realistically he's never going to pay.
I like to kind of ask the question that's a little off what you usually talk about before we conclude, and that is, we talk about the halcyon days of when children were allowed to be children.
Yeah.
when whether you lived in the inner city or whether you lived in the suburbs or somewhere in between, that there were adults and families around you all the time. And the 50s had a lot of problems, but this, I think, is true, I'm about to say. Children were allowed to go out and explore and play, whether it was in the street, in the playground, in the woods, on a tree-lined block, wherever it was. Mm-hmm. And kids go out all day long, and they play, and they do what they do, and then they come home for dinner, and there's always some world around. So children were allowed to kind of be children and to explore and to grow. But now, whether you're a suburban family where the kid is just completely scheduled all the time with no room to breathe, or whether you're an inner-city kid with all the madness in the street and no parents to watch over you, we don't have children. We don't allow people to have childhoods anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we create childhood again?
Well, you know, I do think we have a number of institutions that that need support. I think our departments of recreation and parks need to be supported, particularly when you think about budget cuts, you know, and that's just decimating the resources that should be made available so that we have institutions that are open for children to go in under supervision. I was really a strong proponent of the police athletic league model, all right, particularly when you think about the safety, the health and safety of communities. And so, like, the presence of an officer in an environment where children can go in and, you know, and arguably people are going to respect, you know, that level of authority where children can go in, they can let their guard down. We've taken, you know, young men and their sons away into, you know, wooded areas and out of the city. And when we get away from the city and you see them let their guard down, you know, you see them interacting with their kids and you see there's no threats. You know what I mean? People are living under acute scenarios where a young man can't even walk down the street without looking over his shoulder if he hears a car go by, right? That kind of existence, you know, does not, you know, bode well for adults or for children, right? So we've got to support these systems. You know, there are a number of proposals and examples where schools are opening beyond just your traditional, you know, 8 to 3 and becoming, you know, community centers so that there are activities in the school, you know, up through 6, 7, 8 o'clock. You know, we've got to, you know, kind of support those after school activities, right? We've got to look at boys and girls clubs, right? We've got to look at opportunities where we create after school activities and in school activities, right? Where we engage the guys who happen to bring these children into the world, right? We've got to, and I will dig into this issue until I'm taken away from here, Mark, right? It is absolutely absurd that as a society, we expect to change what is happening in communities, right? Where the men who can influence that environment for children and other adults are not engaged and held accountable, right, and being provided opportunity, right? That is absolutely, I am totally convinced that is the formula that will allow us to turn this thing around, and that is the formula that we have not invested in.
Joe Jones, always good to talk to you.
Mark, you as well.
Thank you.